weeks ago, and we dealt with anxiety, depression, and loneliness. And this week, I've asked a friend of mine who's not new to Living Stones. He and his wife, Cassie, were here several years ago, and Jeremy is a licensed therapist. Been licensed in Missouri as a professional counselor since 2005, earned a national board certification in counseling in 2008. Since 2005, he's worked full-time in the mental health as a therapist and training director. Currently, he's in a private practice in Lee Summit, and he specializes in family issues, adolescents, and Christian counselors, and offers individual marriage and family services. And so Jeremy's just one of those friends that God placed in my life, and we'd meet at Starbucks several times, and just to unload, and just to share what God's doing in our lives. And God used him many times in my life just to help me process things. His wife, Cassie, is an amazing woman. Isn't that right, Cassie? Isn't that what you told me? Yeah. And they have a new son. I say new. They didn't have kids when we were here, but you have a three-year-old son, Camden. And so y'all make Jeremy welcome this morning. Can y'all do that? Give him a Living Stones welcome. Come on up, brother.
Can you guys hear me? Okay. And can you hear me in the back? Okay. So, Anne can hear me, and hopefully I'm out of Ron Smith's throwing distance. Thanks a lot, Dan. I am really excited to be here. This place is really special to me and to Cassie. You guys are really special to me and to Cassie. Living Stones has given me a lot. Sam Cummins is one of my best friends. We met here through a Living Stones small group and have been friends ever since. Dan Roy was the first person on planet Earth that I told that we were pregnant at that same Starbucks off 7 Highway in Blue Springs. And so not going to try to fill any shoes. I can't. Nervous enough as it is. I do encourage you to pedal through the sermons on this series prior. Anxiety, loneliness, and depression. They're fantastic. I've enjoyed doing so myself. This morning, I don't come to you with a deep theological message. I've gone to church my whole life, but my calling has been a little different than that of a pastor. I have felt called to mental health and called to try to bridge the divide between living in the way that the culture says we should, but also living in a way that mental health science informs us to. Over my career, I've tried to bridge Christian daily living principles with what we know from mental health science, and that's what I hope to do today. I hope that you will only learn two things, if nothing else, that you learn that small, consistent changes will work the best. Mental health truly is a game that's played step by step. We tend to get discouraged at not meeting our goals, and oftentimes we're not taking our goals small enough. So let me bring up my notes. So a little of my story is that I didn't learn a lot about nutrition and fitness in 7 years of college. I didn't learn anything, really. When you become a therapist, sorry. I walked right into it, Ron. I didn't learn anything primarily about nutrition and fitness. I am home. You're right, Dan. It feels like home. I get laughed at home. Saying the same stuff. So what happened I was in grad school 2002 to 2004, graduated December of 2004. I had a back injury in 2005, just a few weeks into graduation. Soft tissue damage, I fell on some icy steps, and that set me on about a 4 or 5 year course of navigating the labyrinth of chronic pain and doctor's appointments and traditional medicine. I went to a doctor, got told my back was not damaged beyond soft tissue damage, so no surgery or anything. I was given muscle relaxers and anti-inflammatories and sent home. Over the course of those next 3 to 4 years, I visited close to a dozen doctors, chiropractors, orthopedic people, and there were two steps along that journey that really kind of helped me identify what I now have learned a lot through as being critical ingredients to mental health. The first was that traditional medicine wasn't working for me. I was trying. I didn't miss any dosages of anything. And I didn't get sustained relief at all until 2008, 2009. And so my heart aches for those of you here that are struggling with chronic pain. Ultimately, a chiropractor in Independence told me that I need to go see somebody, where he sent, and I quote, all of my other hopeless cases. And it turned out to be a traditional Chinese acupuncturist in Kansas City. And I had to go 3 times a week for 6 months. And that actually is what remedied the pain and inflammation chronically in my back. The other thing that helped along that journey is that one of those chiropractors, and I learned something, you know how it is, I learned something valuable from each person that I would find myself in the office of, often in the realm of nutrition. And one person in particular, in that same season, I was struggling with a lot of digestive issues. I was, I just finished grad school. I had digestive issues during grad school. And I found that the medication for my digestive issues had a lot of side effects. And a particular chiropractor I was seeing told me that I needed to reduce my intake of dairy products and wheat products. We now know that as like a gluten-free diet. Now it's become popular. Well, I'm kind of a hipster, at least in one sense. Adam, you can write this down. I am a hipster in that I learned about gluten-free principles before it was cool. This was in like 2006. So I was desperate. He told me to read on it, and I want to be careful because I'm a real person. I don't have celiac disease. I don't enjoy nutrition. I don't crave broccoli. So it's important for me to punctuate that. But what happened, and what often happens when people are making changes in nutrition, your brain chemistry changes and your brain starts to crave more of what is being given. So over time, I started to have an easier time craving fruits and veggies, lean meats, nuts and berries, and I had less of an enjoyable experience when I would eat a pizza or eat pasta. And so those two pieces helped me learning. And I grew up in a very traditional medicine home. My mother was a registered nurse in Missouri for over 40 years. There was a pill for everything in my house, and I took it. That's fine. I never could have seen coming the changes in my mood, in my energy, and in my other health situations that nutrition and fitness in particular made. And so that's kind of part of the journey that explores my passion on this subject. I have a family history of anxiety and depression. My whole family is on medication for digestive issues. And so I say all this to you today and what we're going to pedal through with the ultimate hope of encouraging you to take small steps, because there are things that you can do, and I'm not going to bash medication. I'm a proponent of psychotropic medication. We'll talk about that. We need to have a balanced perspective regarding how we can implement some wellness principles. Wellness principles are the key to mental health. In nearly 15 years, I've seen a lot of people have unrealistic expectations regarding a specific therapist, a program, or a pill. I'm here to tell you it's a 100-mile march, but you will make progress taking these three steps that we're going to talk about today. And so I am not a poster child for longevity in the field of mental health because of my family history, and I tend to be a pretty tightly wound, nervous person. My wife could tell you that I'm a stress ball, and so I don't embrace these principles recreationally. I embrace these principles because I want vitality in my life. I feel called to encourage and equip others through my counseling experiences. And I need energy. I need restorative sleep. I need a healthy brain to facilitate those things and to live out the kingdom dream that God has for me. So to get to our handout, the three things, and I'm going to refer to this throughout, and that's going to stay up there. And I encourage you to just jot it on a whiteboard, on your fridge, on the page in your planner. And I'm going to speak a little bit about this. So these are the three cornerstones of wellness. And when I do assessments for anybody, whether it's adolescent, child, individual adult, I will assess these things. You can even see, they're in my intake paperwork. I ask clients, prospective clients, to complete a report card, if you will, in certain areas, certain wellness areas, because neuroscience has indicated these three pieces are inextricably linked to mental flourishing. You cannot have strong deficits in these areas. And in therapy school and in mental health in general, we focus a lot on the mind and how to think and how to communicate and how to triage problems and how to resolve conflict assertively, not passively, not aggressively. I argue that these three pieces work as kind of a gaping hole in a lot of traditional mental health services. And that's kind of where I've lived. The first 5 years of my career, I worked in secular mental health, specializing in long-term adolescent care that's residential. And since then, I worked in long-term residential that was faith-based, and now in private practice. These pieces are missing in terms of our diagnostic exploration when we're helping clients figure out how to move ahead in their journey on what we've been talking about here: loneliness, anxiety, and depression. So sleep is at the bottom because it's the foundation. It's the foundation of mental health. Ongoing sleep deprivation alone. So it should be sleep, nutrition, and then exercise. Those are in order of importance. I triage those in those ways. Sleep is at the bottom because it's the foundation work. If I'm working with somebody with strong function, we work our way up the pyramid pretty quickly in our homework assignments. If there's strong dysfunction or strong dysregulation or strong dependency, for example, on sleep medications, which really wreak havoc long-term on your REM cycles and on your circadian rhythms, which we'll talk about. Sleep is first. I don't go on to nutrition or exercise. until the person is sleeping better. And I encourage you to prioritize in your pursuits toward wellness, to focus in that area first. So we're going to talk about sleep. So the first blank is sleep, the second is nutrition, and the third is exercise. Exercise, again, is at the top because I go there last. It's kind of similar to the food pyramid in its format. Ongoing sleep deprivation can resemble virtually every sign of dysfunction in the DSM-5, which is the therapist's Bible. It's a diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders, 5th edition. I cannot find success generally in gaining diagnostic clarity until I've stabilized sleep patterns in the client. The next blank is, this one's a little tight. I'm sorry about that. Treating poor sleep quantity or quality is the first step in mental health. So people tend to have issues, either they can't fall asleep or they can't stay asleep. If you sat with the sleep doctor, they would probably comb those areas really, really carefully. So I find out, are you finding difficulty staying asleep? Or is it more an issue of falling asleep? But treating poor sleep quantity or quality is the first step in mental health, always. Always. Insomnia can be a side effect of a lot of meds. Causes of sleep issues can be numerous, but they tend to fall into two camps. First is technology. The second is overcommitment. We are very anxious, as Adam did a good job of articulating earlier in the series. We're anxious in large part because people were taking in far too much information. The average person in today's society receives more inputs, that's cognitive inputs or sensory information coming to you, than a person 100 years ago received in a whole lifetime. So we are waterboarded with information, with sensory stimulation, and it creates a problem in our brains. So technology, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I'm going to talk a lot about that, but I'm going to do so concisely. We got to manage our relationship with tech. You've got to. Our brains do not work like an iPhone. It's how to battle screens and gadgets with adolescents is the number one most common problem. It's easily the most frequently asked question that I get. So the average adult checks their smartphone 80 to 160 times a day. I'm not here to bash technology. We've just got to be wise about managing our relationship to it. And we'll be rewarded. There's a lot to celebrate. I'm seeing a lot of people that society and stereotypes would assume won't put down gadgets, because the results sell themselves. It feels great to get a good night's sleep. You do that over time, you're going to build a lifestyle of flourishing. You're going to have more energy, you're going to have greater concentration, and you're going to have an easier time being a upbeat, joy-filled, admirable, marketable Christian for those that we encounter at work that are pre-Christians. So technology and overcommitment are the two primary umbrella terms for what pervades our sleep-challenged landscape. So to do less, and I left all these on here for you because it's so important to me that there be some things, a lot of things, I hope, that you can walk into tomorrow with to do differently as a result of today. First is screen access. Neurologists technically recommend people under the age of 3 not be exposed to screens at all. 90% of the brain's anatomy is completed by age 5. The sensory overload of screens, cartoons, the colors, the sounds, the rapid flashing of screens, it interrupts brain development. So 3 and under, as hard as it might sound, do with it what you will. We all need to live in the real world, but no screen time is generally recommended because of how much neurological development is happening that in that season of life. And then it gets better from there. If kids grow so much between the first 3 ages of life, if we continue to grow at that rate throughout the rest of our lives, we would be the size of an aircraft carrier. Like, that's true. Like, it's not hyperbole. And so that season of life is one that we don't want to mess with if we don't have to. After age 3, hour or less a day tends to be fine. For adults, 2 to 3 hours of screen time tends to be the ceiling of what people recommend. That poses a lot of challenges if you have a job. So if you own a TV, if you look at the news, if you're texting people for work, so that's important. We can make improvements. For example, consider one day per week. I do this a lot with therapy clients. One day per week, eliminate screen access within 2 hours from bedtime. If you go to bed at 11 o'clock on Friday night, no screens after 9, one time. Watch what happens. For me, that time is boring because I want to vegetate. I want to passively scroll. I want to lay in bed and tune out. And doing that sometimes, doing that regularly is fine. But I encourage you to explore reducing your screen access in the evening. And oftentimes, I don't have to do any sales work because by the second week, and this is true, I have a lot of high school students coming in and out. This is true for them as well. They're like, well, yeah, I did it. I went to bed at 10. I put my phone in the kitchen at 8. I slept so good, dude. You don't even know. Well, I kind of do. Like, it was my idea. And I see the same thing. So they're going to be like, you know, hey, I'm doing it 2 times next week. I'm like, hey, you know what? That's fine. You do you. Okay. But it generally sells itself because teenagers need upwards of 8 to 10 hours of sleep. And it's being challenged by digital ingestion. Screen light. All of you have an iPhone or an Android. You have stock apps that can restrict blue light waves on your phone. They're free. They're on your phone. You can set it. You can take your, from at least for Android, you can do the drop-down menu here at the top, and you can go to blue light filter, double-click, and you'll get a schedule. You can set it to go on and off at a certain time. What has worked for me and has helped me as I've tried to phase this stuff in is to set it to go on at 6 p.m. and turn off at 6 a.m. I never have to mess with it. If you're going to use your phone in the evening, the later in the evening it becomes, the dimmer your screen should be. Blue light waves, it restricts your body's production of cortisol, which you need to kind of fall asleep. It hampers the body's production and engagement with melatonin, which is kind of a sleepy chemical. Same with tryptophan. We only think of tryptophan with turkey and Thanksgiving. Your body produces tryptophan the other days of the year as well. Your REM cycles get messed up. Your circadian rhythms get out of whack. And so we can do a lot of good. And so the other day, I really wanted to take a hot bath and watch some TV. So I turned my MacBook, I turned my brightness down to the setting below black. And I just emphasized the volume, soaked in the tub, and I slept fine. So these things need to be taken in steps, but the places to start regarding sleep and also anxiety, I would argue, would be screen access and screen light. You can also get aftermarket apps. There's one called S-Filter. It's free in the App Store if you want to kind of double up. But sleep meds. Sleep meds are fine. They serve a purpose for a season. The problem is that by the time you're in my office, that season has been way too long. So sleep medicines like Ambien can do a lot of the same things that I've talked about that screen time and blue light waves can do. We want our brain to learn how to put itself to sleep. Preferably not here today while I'm talking, but tonight. Your brain is a very, very efficient machine. God designed it with unbelievable precision and efficiency. It's not going to do any work that it's expecting a substance, a chemical, or a pill to do. So as you taper or titrate down from sleep meds, which long-term studies have shown actually causes greater disruptions in sleep quality and quantity than it does improve. So we're not built to be on sleep medicine forever. And if you have friends or relatives that have, they need to consider tapering and doing some of the things that we're talking about today. Caffeine's a drug. It's not a beverage. It's a drug I love, but we need to be cautious. It stays in our system longer than we realize. I try to turn off caffeine on most days if I can, about 2 p.m. For a lot of people, that's too early, so I'll start them at 6 p.m. I've got a high school student that works at Culver's, and he drinks an energy drink on his way home from work. You know, if six is too late, let's start with 7. Let's start with 8. I promise you'll see improvements. It's not all or nothing. Satan gets such encouragement when his people believe that these guidelines that cultivate flourishing rely on perfection. Rely on a legalistic maintenance of all these things. It's about small steps. In fact, studies show that people that maintain weight loss are those that make the weight loss the slowest. Small steps win. They win the battle against depression and anxiety, and they win it every time over fast, drastic change, which I've had a window seat to view for 15 years almost. We really should, for point five, we really should stick to a sleep schedule as best we can. You can't get caught up on sleep on the weekend. Sleep schedules help our brain. Our brain is an instrument that really likes routine. Pre-bed working is a no-no. There's a reason why people, 5,000 years ago. Anybody know what they used to refer to the bedroom as? It's called a sleeping chamber. I heard that from somebody. You guys are all too young to have had one, except for Dan. Yeah. But I love you, Dan. But there's some truth to that. Evening consumption of these things, you know, I spelled that wrong, I'm sorry. Sugars, carbs, alcohol, nicotine, all those things the body understands as sugar. We really want to cultivate more of a nutritional pattern and habits in the evening that's protein rich. So less of those things, more of these things. Cultivate a sleep schedule. Prepare the bedroom. You can get an essential oil diffuser, and you can diffuse peppermint oil, lemongrass. Those scents work with the brain to activate the brain's brake pedal on the right hemisphere versus the brain's gas pedal on the left side. You can experiment with that, but there's like a lavender sleep spray, little potpourri you can put on your bed, you can put on your pillows. Adam has that, he loves it. I'm just kidding. You can create rituals, prepare your bedroom, dim the lights, close the windows, cover things up. Protein in the evening, it's going to help get you through the night. It actually really works to improve sleep quality compared to a heavy dosage of pasta, breads, carbs, sugar in the evening. Your brain functions largely on glucose. We want our brain to kind of slow down. So we don't feed our brain glucose before we go to bed. Physical relaxation is important. Start winding down. In some of the treatment programs I've worked in, we would have sleepy time tea. It's just a natural sleep tea. You can get it at Walmart. It can help relax. It creates some rituals. We had some of the most dysfunctional teenagers in America, including all my teen guys, gathering around excited for sleepy time. Like, come on, dude, we gotta get downstairs. We gotta fire up the microwave, put in our sleep tea. So rituals can be unique, but we wanna help our body kind of wind down. Our body needs that. It takes about 30 minutes for your system to kind of slow down. So we can't hop into bed and fall asleep. It doesn't work. There's a quote I like from a book that's on here. Dr. Korn, who unsurprisingly specializes in nutrition, wrote a book that I gave you the reference to, as well as a podcast. She has a statement that says, and this is on their back page at the top, mood follows food. Mood follows food. We live in a society that has a lot less nutrition than it does food. And it's not a fair fight. We have to eat. Scientists are designing food for maximum shock and engagement of our salt, sugar, and fat receptors. It gives us a quick burst and then a steep fall. It promotes mood swings, irritability, low energy, and attention. That's processed foods. And Dr. Korn would argue that's pretty much any variety of white flour or white sugar. It's not clear anymore. Those substances do tend to be neurotoxic. And if we can gradually reduce our intake of them, we find ourselves experiencing greater mood stability, less irritability, less agitation, greater and better sleep, stronger attention. One of the first things I do when I'm treating ADHD is to try to help reduce the dependence on a school lunch, which is very processed and focused with like breaded proteins. Increase a higher protein, high fat, your brain is 70% fat. And we need good fats. We need the polyunsaturated fats. We need the monounsaturated fats. Think olive oil, think avocado. We need those things. If you dine out, there's kind of a tax to be paid beyond gratuity. Food today is chock full for the reasons I've stated. It's chock full of salt. Even if it's healthy, good, high quality, expensive food out at a restaurant, it's built with preservatives and it's built for shelf life. And I get it. If I owned a restaurant, I would do that too. The less you eat out, the more clients tell me they find themselves getting thirsty easier when they do eat out. And taking your lunch to work is a way that I often see clients improve their areas of functioning regarding anxiety and depression. Depression is now understood not to be about neurotransmitter imbalance, but about inflammation. you can reduce inflammation by eating purple foods, berries, etc. I've got a 28-year-old client who's being treated for depression. He works at home, opens up a clamshell of strawberries, and eats them while they work. No one really has that much of a problem with fruit. Broccoli's a harder sell, I get that. But the brain and the gut, they crave what they're given. The gut is considered by scientists now to be the second brain. You cannot have, according to Dr. Korn, and she said in over 30 years of treating, I've never seen mental illness without digestive illness. And I've seen that too. Anxiety, ADHD, trauma often expresses itself through digestion issues. I say often, I kind of mean always. I've never treated anxiety in a child without them having issues with bathroom stuff, with stomach stuff. So we can change our brain. We can change our moods. 90% of serotonin, which is a pleasure-producing chemical that our brain makes on its own because of God's design, 90% of it is created in the gut, in the digestive system. When you take Lexapro for depression, it's a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. You're trying to boost your body's production of serotonin. We can do that with nutrition. With meds often work well to help people start doing the other things. Start improving sleep, start improving nutrition, get to the gym, get to my office. I'm often encouraging people to get on medications while doing these things. And then a lot of people these days don't want to be on medications. Two-thirds of people that try antidepressants don't feel any better. So they try a few more, and then a third of those people, according to studies, don't feel any better still. So I'm not anti-med, but my clients often are because they've not worked. And if they have worked, there are side effects that need to be managed with more pills. And all I'm saying is that there are many doors through which we can enter a house of healing, not just a pill, not just a plate of food. We need to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves on this issue and be open. Start with fruit. Fruit is easier to figure out and to accept than vegetables. So start with fruit and go slow. Nobody's really anti-blueberry or anti-blackberries. Nobody. I don't ever hear. I work with some really feisty people, and I don't have people bark about those things. Carb addiction is real. Sugar is a carbohydrate. When we're stressed, our brain craves sugar. There are people that crave sugar. There are people that crave salt. Our cravings tell us something. So if we're encouraging a protein, like a heavier protein-rich diet, and I'm not here to say you need to go paleo or you need to go this, or you need to go that, it depends upon the person. I know enough to know that. So you need to figure out what approach works for you, but understand mental health is telling us that people are often using carbohydrates, especially in the evening, chips, pasta, alcohol, as a medicine. Protein is a force multiplier. It increases thermogenesis, which helps boost metabolism. It also helps resist hunger, keeps hunger pangs at bay, better than carbs do. It helps you outlast the glucose curve. We want things that are going to stick with us through the afternoon. When I made the change to become more of a grazer, I reduced my overall intake of grains in the afternoon. I had more energy that mid-afternoon slump. So there's two resources there. There's a book that is very helpful. There's a podcast that's also very helpful. Regarding exercise, I'm going to fly through this because you guys know it all. The first blank, everybody knows. I'm not going to tell you to park farther away to Walmart. You know that. I'm not going to tell you to eat a salad instead of a donut. You know that. I don't want this to be about taking the stairs instead of the elevator. That's fine, but you know that. What I want you to do is reduce activation energy. I work with a lot of really smart people, smarter than me, but they're not going to the gym because going to the gym is too darn hard in their schedules. So I carry a backpack with gym clothes to work every day. When I go, if I work out during the day, I take it home. I don't set it down. I go home in the back, I go into my house with the backpack on, go upstairs, change it out, put it back in my trunk. There's a reason why Steve Jobs and Barack Obama advocated wearing the same clothes all the time. The uniform, as it was dubbed in some circles. President Obama said, I don't want to worry about what I wear. I want to have time and energy for what matters. I'm like, wow, that's a boss. That's the story behind the black turtleneck. It wasn't a fashion thing. Make good habits easier and make bad habits harder. When I have people that will often sleep in their gym clothes as soon as they're trying to build that habit, do meal prep. So on an average weekend day, I might have, as I'm attuning to these issues and the rhythms of my day, I might take a nap. I have a three-year-old. I might take a nap when he's napping. That takes the sleep. When I wake up from the nap, if my son is not awake, or if I have more time, I'll do some meal prep. I'll cook some chicken breasts on the grill and prepare some vegetables for the week ahead. That same day, I may not have time for exercise. No problem. The next day, I've gotten a good night's sleep from the day prior. I've got food prepped already. I can go to the gym before work. I can take a walk during work. The World Health Organization has indicated it only takes an hour a week of exercise to reduce clinically significant depression symptoms. You don't need to become Michael Phelps. And a lot of people think you do. Seek progress, not perfection. Some of the best vitamins that people can take, B12 complex is great for mood and energy level and focus. There are some other ones listed on there. Fish oil is doing a great job in high doses of treating depression because it's a strong anti-inflammatory and because the brain is 70% fat. We need those good fats. Magnesium helps with mood. 1 in 3 people are deficient in at least one mineral. The program that works is the program you work. You open some berries at your desk when you're doing email. You do some body weight squats, some push-ups before a challenging teleconference or a presentation, or while the kids are asleep. You work on screen time. You work a little bit on dimming the screen, diminishing access, taking some of these things slowly. You're going to experience less anxiety. You're going to experience less depression. It's how things work. So what I love about this sermon series has been that we have answers. Your anxiety, your depression, God doesn't want that for you. Satan's plan in depression is to get you to doubt the goodness and the greatness of God. Being outside is a force multiplier. The brain grows through physical motor and sensory motor. I talked a little bit about essential oils, other things you can do. Outside, you get vitamin D, you get sensory stimulation from birds, you get sun, you get all the things that can create a symphony of relaxation in your body. So when you do stuff, you can do it outside and have it be a force multiplier. We know that individual and team rewards work, whether it's a weight loss challenge at work or whether it's you buying yourself $100 worth of gym clothes or going on a small trip or a weekend vacation after you meet a goal. We know that those work. We know that those things work. As we wrap up, I want to thank Dan and Adam for this series. I've been going to church my whole life. This is notably absent from the Christian landscape in our work as Christians. People are hurting. It's really, really easy to be unhealthy. It's not a fair fight. We have scientists, we have marketing, we have advertising, we have social media telling us who we should be, what we should look like. But God cares about your vitality. He tells us this in John 10:10. I've come that you might have life and have it to the fullest. Some translations say have it in its abundance. We're not going to spiritually flourish while we physically languish. That's on your sheet under closing thoughts. We won't spiritually flourish while we physically languish. Compare yourself primarily to you. You'll get discouraged if you're comparing yourself to the ectomorphic person that eats almonds for fun next to you at the office. Compare yourself primarily to you. Focus more on health than you do appearance. There's a book I'm getting into called Every Body Matters by Gary Thomas. He says that our body is an instrument, not an ornament. And God built us for vitality and not vanity. He's a great Christian book author. He's written other books. His name is Gary Thomas. The book is called Every Body Matters. It's available in all formats, and it'll bless you. Prioritize rejuvenation over entertainment. Nobody remembers their best evening of passively scrolling Instagram. Go outside. Go outside with somebody you love. Take some vitamins. Take some water with you. The AMA, the American Medical Association, recommends we pursue half our body weight in ounces per day. 100-pound person, that's 50 ounces of water. I weigh almost 200 pounds. I try to down 3 of these a day. Move in small steps and you will make improvements. Take the smallest step that you can take. Take the smallest step. If you haven't exercised in a month, if you haven't eaten a salad in a year, do something small. Don't let Satan trick you. Satan's the second best psychologist ever. Second best. God would say, take it slow. Do it with a friend. Trust God. Lastly, trust God. The last blank. Trust God, not you. Flesh can't heal the flesh. Earth to all of us. God's plan for your vitality and flourishing is not you. It's Him. It's wisdom. It's fellowship. It's trust. God is going to fight for you harder than you could ever imagine fighting for yourself. Your body, your mind, your body that you have to live in, your soul that you are. We're not our body. We're not our spirit. We're a soul with a body. We just have to live with this body. So let's help promote its flourishing. God will fight for you. I will pray for you, and then we'll move ahead. God, thank you so much for Adam, for Dan, for this series. Thank you that they listen to you. Thank you that they're fighting for every person in this room. Your plan is for one to have life and to have it in abundance, to be Christians who are joy-filled and upbeat and rested and connected and laughing. And we need your help. We need your help to counteract a toxic culture in areas of our sleep, nutrition, and fitness. Help us trust you. Help us feel you fighting for us in the days ahead. We're going to trust you for this because you tell us that we can, and it's where peace is found. We love you, Jesus. It's in your name we pray. Amen.